To us today. If you can stick around after this argument is over, I'm going to meet with other students who I understand are coming back who are here for the first argument, and we'll talk a little bit about procedures in the court, how a matter gets to the Supreme Court, how it proceeds through other courts in order to get here if it does. So if you have time to stick around, do. I'm going to stay as soon as the argument is over, and I'll stick around and talk to you for about 10 minutes and answer questions if you have some questions. Not questions about the cases, however, that are pending, just more generalized court questions. So with that little bit of information out of the way, our second case, Madison Teachers versus Scott, are you prepared to proceed? Please do.
May it please the court. My name is Stephen Kilpatrick. I'm an assistant attorney general with the Wisconsin Department of Justice, and I am here representing James Scott, defendant appellant, in his former capacity as records custodian and Wisconsin Employment Relations Commission chairman. This case is first and foremost about public records law question that arose because of 2011 Act 10, which, as you know, changed public sector collective bargaining rights across the state. Act 10 did not amend the public records law directly, but it did create two key provisions that has produced a balancing test question for the WERC custodian that has never been before posed or answered prior to this litigation. This case also raises questions about attorney's fees provisions in the public records law, but those questions don't need to be answered if this court reverses the Dane County Circuit Court's decision, which I urge this court to do. Some statutory background may be relevant here. Act 10 required that annual certification elections take place, as we just heard. School district employees vote in the elections in the fall of each year. Other municipal employees vote in the spring. And Act 10 also required that to become an exclusive collective bargaining unit representative, the entity running for election had to receive 51% of all the employees in the unit. So this standard essentially makes a non-vote a no-vote. It gives the same weight to a non-vote as a no-vote. So in 2015, certification elections ran during a 20-day period, from November 4th to November 24th. And voting did not take place in person. Employees did not cast paper ballots. They voted electronically, either by telephone or online. And the WERC contracted with the American Arbitration Associations to help conduct the election via electronic means. So in the fall of 2015, there were really three public records law requests, two of which have been litigated, but all three are relevant here. So request number one by Madison Teachers, and they made it for the names of those employees who had voted at a certain point in the election. And what is important to know is that the names of all the employees was public. So by asking for and receiving, possibly, the names of those who had voted, it would be easy to determine who had not voted. So request number one was on November 10th. That was denied by Chairman Scott on November 16th. MTI made another request November 17th for the same records. That was denied November 30th after the elections were over. Also, request number three, which is not being litigated but still important, on November 24th, after the elections, MTI asked for a list of all the voters who had voted in the elections that were over. The day after that happened, Chairman Scott provided that list to the requester.
I have a question for you about that, because one of the reasons the chairman gave for denying the first two requests was, of course, the risk of voter coercion and intimidation. And I understand the argument that once the election had taken place, that would go away. However, isn't that really an ongoing risk and concern? Because then the union would have that list of people who did not vote, and potentially that could mean, or it was, a no vote. Couldn't they then be, those non-voters, be subject to intimidation and coercion in the next election?
That is completely possible, Your Honor, yes. But in a balancing test question, there needs to be, it's a fact-intensive question. And in a balancing test, here, Chairman Scott decided that the public policy of transparency in government, of the public knowing WERC conducted and administered a free and fair election, was paramount on the scales for allowing disclosure of the names after the elections were over as opposed to during. So Chairman Scott decided under the balancing test that disclosure after the elections furthered transparency in government by allowing the public to see that this happened, that the elections were conducted properly. But during the election, that public policy had to give way to the other stronger public policy of conducting fair elections without voter intimidation and without coercion.
So there's a strong public policy to protect against intimidation and coercion in the present election, but not in the next?
No, there is certainly in both. But what Chairman Scott decided was that during the election, because this was an electronic voting election, that a non-vote was essentially the same as a no vote, that during the election, that disclosure would not be proper, and that the coercion element, that public policy of anti-coercion, outweighed the policy of disclosure during the election.
So I understand it's more immediate, right? I mean, there's an ongoing election, but there's going to be another election, and then it will be immediate again. Mm-hmm. And yet, in the next one, when it becomes immediate, the union will have the roadmap to everyone who voted no by not casting a ballot in the last election, mm-hmm. right?
Right, that's correct, Your Honor.
Okay, so if it's an immediate concern in the present election, and it will become an immediate concern in the next election, how does that change the balance?
Well, again, in this situation, you can see from the examples that were in the record. As you know, we had stated, and Chairman Scott had referred to the complaint that had been filed by the Racine School Board in the previous year's certification election, so just a year before, in 2014. It was easy to see, based on those allegations, how in electronic voting election, coercion and intimidation could take place during this 20-day period. There were allegations that union representatives entered the school, entered the classroom of the teachers, brought their own computer, a laptop computer, or asked the teacher to sit down at his or her own laptop computer
right.
to
let's,
vote.
Let's say all that's true.
Yep.
Right. Let's assume that. And that's a good enough reason to ward against that kind of thing happening. That's a good enough reason not to release that list. But that list is going to exist in the next election, and isn't it important to ward against that in the next election as well?
It could be important, yes.
Could be or is?
Well, it is important, but in this situation, Chairman Scott decided that the transparency of government, that strong public policy, the policy of disclosure, with regard to request number 3, was paramount over the voter coercion public policy at that time afterwards. So one thing we need to remember here is that the third request isn't being challenged. It's being challenged with the first two.
Yeah, I'm just trying to figure out why the interest in transparency is greater with respect to the next election than it is in the present election.
Because of the immediacy, Your Honor, of the election. There's a 20-day period. You can see from the examples that when a non-vote is equal to a no vote, that in this case, the Racine union officials were intimidating and coercing other employees to vote. So the immediacy of the election, I believe, was a factor in that sense.
Well, the point, though, is that there are other ways of combating coercion. You don't have to do it through not giving these records. There are other legal means of fighting the coercion.
Right.
And you've got a very strong public policy of transparency, right?
Correct.
So how can you defend not giving the these records?
After the election?
During the election.
Well, he didn't obviously provide the records during the election.
That's right. That's what the fight's about, isn't
right.
it?
Right. So I'm sorry I didn't understand your question then, Your Honor.
It's okay. So if you've got other means of fighting coercion, mm-hmm. and you've got a strong public policy of releasing these records, right? And so how can you defend not releasing the records?
Well, the tools against coercion could be after-the-fact tools, right? And so during the election, these requests were received during the election. And again, the immediacy, the timing of the requests is a key and paramount factor here in this decision. Afterwards, yes, the WERC can address coercion and intimidation.
And what's the remedy if there's coercion and intimidation?
Well, as you can see, prohibited practice complaint could be one. And again, that's an after-the-fact remedy.
Do you get a new election if there's been coercion and intimidation?
If the Racine matter showed that after the election, the Racine school board filed an objection to the election results and made those allegations of voter intimidation and coercion. The WERC's rule and case law, which I believe is based on the rule, says that an investigation may take place if it believes that there's going to be a change in the result of the election. So in this case, the WERC, in the Racine case, decided that there would be no change in the outcome of the election and therefore didn't investigate. So there could be a change in the election based on an objection.
What's the scope of the ruling that you're requesting? Is it a blanket ruling that names in all recertification shouldn't be released? During the election process?
No, Your Honor. We're not asking for a blanket rule. Yes, it's true that Act 10 did create the 51%.
Okay.
That's in the statute.
If I may, because I perhaps inartfully stated my question, could you articulate what is your requested holding?
Okay. All that we're asking here, Chairman Scott is asking here, is that his decisions... in the fall of November 2015, that his denial decisions be upheld. And under those facts, this is what happened. He had, at that point, fresh allegations of intimidation and coercion. There was a 20-day election period going on via electronic means. And those are facts that don't always replicate themselves. So it would not be a blanket rule, and we're certainly not asking for a blanket rule. We're simply saying at under the circumstances, under this case, balancing test, fact-intensive inquiry, we're asking that his denials be upheld so that the circuit court decision be reversed.
So what you're, to piggyback on Justice Bradley's question. So you're not asking us to say that because provision of the votes cast by just the names of the people who are voting passed, you're not asking us to say that every time it's requested and denied that the balance was proper.
That's correct, Your Honor. We're not asking for that. And I would submit to you that this is similar to public records requests for documents and records during an ongoing police investigation. In that situation, there is a governmental activity going on, the conducting of an investigation, a records request is made, and the balancing test is required to be conducted before a custodian may deny access to the records, and usually that happens. And the reason is that they want to maintain the integrity of the police investigation, and usually after the police investigation is concluded, the records may be released. So here, what's going on is there is a ongoing governmental activity, the conducting of an election. Afterwards, in this particular case, the names of all the voters were released. So this is similar to that type of a balancing test, that maybe a majority of the time during a certification election and a request is made, there may be a denial. But it's not a blanket rule. It's a balancing test.
Trump's asking us to look at each of the reasons that were advanced in the commissioner's letter denying the request for disclosure, or are you focused merely on the voter intimidation and coercion risk? The reason I ask is because another basis for the denial that was advanced in his letter was that the record didn't exist, because as I understand it, the AAA was collecting the data, and so the data existed in the AAA's computer system, but perhaps there was no record. Could you speak to that?
Right. So that certainly was the first reason that was given, that they weren't records. That has been abandoned during litigation. So what we're arguing for now is simply based on the voter intimidation aspect and the secret ballot aspect. The reason I believe that was placed in Chairman Scott's letter was, as you said, that these weren't paper ballots. This was data in a computer system or a telephone system that the AAA was managing. And I believe Chairman Scott looked at it and said, well, are there even records here? And that was the reason for that statement in the letter. But it's clear that he abandoned that position a day after the election, because a day after the election, he provided a list of names of all the voters to MTI.
But during the election, was the AAA generating any type of report, either electronically or in written form, for the commission or anyone else?
No, Your Honor. And Chairman Scott did put in his affidavit that never before, at least during his tenure with the WERC, had he or anyone else from the commission contacted the AAA during the pendency of an election to seek records, to seek information, to seek a list of voters. What does happen during an election, and that is in the record as well, if there are concerns by certain voters or employees of the unit that maybe their vote didn't count, then what happens is, as you can see from the record, there's email strings from MTI to WERC legal counsel. For instance, I didn't think my vote counted. Send an email to legal counsel. He may figure out with the AAA whether something has been counted, a vote has been counted or not, and that's fixed. But there's never a request by WERC for a list of names of who voted.
Is it accurate to say that the requested records did not exist during the course of the election, but they did exist post-election?
It's possible. I mean, yes, Your Honor, that is the first reason that was given. So during the course of the election, is it possible that there were no records to be given? That's, again, one of the reasons.
But is it in the record as to whether or not the record, in fact, existed during the course of the election?
There's nothing in the record because there was no communication from Chairman Scott to the AAA during the pendency of the election.
Thank you.
There's nothing in the record to indicate that any attempt to get the underlying data. Is that correct?
That's correct, right, during the course of the election. Yeah. Of course, after the election, part of the contract between the WERC and the AAA was that immediately upon the conclusion of the election, the AAA would provide to the commission a list of those voters. And so at that point, then, the WERC had a list of the voters, in getting to your question, Justice Scalia, then decided that under a balancing test, that the transparency of showing the public and the workings of government, again, which is one of the points of the public records law, outweighed any possible or probable voter coercion for next year's election.
So, counsel,
I wonder, counsel, why it is, if you know, and if it's in the record, why it is if there were no records on point at the time of the original request during the election, why the answer simply wasn't no such records exist at this time.
Well, I think Chairman Scott was putting forth that as the first answer, that I've received this request during the election. All the votes are in the hands of the AAA. They're in electronic form. They're data right now. There's no paper ballots. There are no records. However, if that is incorrect, here's another reason why I'm denying you access. So the first would be there are no records, which actually I believe isn't even truly a denial under the public records law. But then second,
can you repeat that, which isn't even true? What did you say?
I don't believe that not having a record telling the requester that no record exists may even be a denial of a request for a record. I believe case law does show that. But that's beside the point because Justice Gableman, his next alternative arguments or reasons were, I am denying your request because I have performed the balancing test. And even if there were records under the balancing test, I would believe that the public policy of preventing voter intimidation and coercion during the pendency of this election outweighs any benefit of disclosure of names of those who have voted at certain points and snapshots during the election.
Why didn't the commission respond to the first two requests after the election? I understand that there was a date and time limit on the response
right.
that was advanced in the records request letter, but it appears, based on your arguments and the record, that the commission could have gotten this data into a report form after the election and provided it.
Right, and I don't disagree that the commission, Chairman Scott, could have provided a list of the names of the two snapshots during the election. Just at the same time, he provided the list of all the names. One reason, and the legal reason, is that there's Attorney General opinion from 1984 that states that these public records requests are not like civil discovery. They're not like ongoing requests. That the records custodian may consider the date of the request and the circumstances at the time of the request when eventually responding. So at the time he received the request, it was in the middle of the election. He didn't have to wait until after he couldn't say, I'll get back to you later on when the election's over. That's not even possible under the public records law. It's comply or deny. So during the election, he said, denied. Afterwards, he could have, if he wanted to, there would be nothing in the public records law that would have prevented him from doing so. He just chose not to. And practically speaking, is that the disclosure of all the names of the voters at that point, I believe he thought satisfied the first two requests. At that point, you know, is there any reason to provide a snapshot list after the election is over? But that's a practical reason, not a reason for the denial in the first instance.
So, counsel, my understanding is there are two ways to cast a no vote because of the way these elections are structured, either by casting a ballot that says no or by not casting a ballot at all, correct?
That's right.
Okay. And the election is to be conducted according to a secret ballot?
Correct.
Is the ballot entitled to secrecy even after the election is over?
Yes. So, The statute does make reference to a secret ballot. So at no point, even after the elections, are the ballots that are cast in this electronic form ever disclosed to the public. So,
but the fact that somebody voted is disclosed.
The fact
you can't tell anyone else how the person voted.
That's right. So if at the end of the, after the conclusion of the election, if there is knowledge, a list, so when Joe Smith didn't vote, we know that he effectively voted no.
Right. So so the chairman's position, if I understand it correctly then, is that a ballot that was cast that says no is entitled to secrecy after the election is over, but a non-ballot, which is the functional equivalent of a no, is not entitled to secrecy after the election is over.
That's correct. But during the election, it is, under the balancing test, subject to, lack of better word, secrecy. Right. And again, it's because of the immediacy of the election and what could take place during the election, the intimidation and coercive factors. So again, this is public policy. These are public policies, events through statutes. So the chairman said during the election.
Well, I must ask a point of clarification.
Sure.
A few minutes ago, I understood you to answer Justice Kelly's question when he said, and so the vote is entitled to confidentiality, to secrecy. And you said, yes. And then this is, of course, building off the premise that no vote, not voting, is the equivalent of a no vote.
Right.
And so by disclosing the list of the people who did not vote, you, your client disclosed the votes that you just said were secret. Can you explain that apparent juxtaposition for me?
I need to ask permission. I have the red light, but may I answer?
Yes, briefly, please.
Okay. Yes, Jerry, I guess I misspoke. The vote is never, the act of voting is never secret. The ballot is certainly secret. After an election is finished, no ballot will ever be disclosed. The act of not voting is a non-vote, but the chairman decided that because of transparency
it's
after the election.
Non-vote that equals a no vote. Sorry, the red light is on. I will stop.
Yes.
Okay. But please, if you were not done finishing your answer, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Yeah, just very quickly, the act of not voting is not given the same protection as the ballot.
Thank you. You may need to adjust the microphone down just a little bit, or maybe even the podium. Yeah, that's better. Thank you.
Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Susan Crawford. I'm from Pines Bach in Madison, and I'm representing Madison Teachers, Inc. This case presents some important issues regarding public access to government records. And I think the context here is important. As you've heard today, the WERC administers annual elections for public employees to select their representative for purposes of collective bargaining. They conduct all of those elections electronically. Employees vote either by phone or by computer. Now, this system is not a perfect system. Mr. Scott's brief on page 7 lists several examples of problems that employees encountered with their votes not going through, with their names not being in the system, with them not receiving confirmation of the votes, et cetera. So the need for oversight of this election process that the WERC administers is apparent, is evident in the record here. Now, there's no way for citizens to monitor the WERC's administration of the election due to the use of technology. What was formerly an open and observable government process is now closed. The only opportunity that the public has for oversight of the WERC's election administration is through public records. And there is a strong public interest in ensuring that the recertification elections that are conducted by the WERC are transparent and open to ensure the integrity of those elections. The public records law serves a basic tenet of our democratic system, as this court has said repeatedly in many cases, and that is of providing the opportunity for public insight or oversight into the workings of government. Now, turning to the specific issue here, the Madison teachers requested a record that was created by the WERC during the administration of this election to recertify MTI, and it sought the record of the employees who had voted at a specific point halfway through the election period. The election period is 20 days.
Would it have been sufficient if WERC had provided those records but had replaced the names with a unique identifier that could not be traced to an individual?
I don't think that would be permitted under the public records law, Your Honor. The public records law, as counsel for Mr. Scott said just a moment ago, is it allows the custodian either to grant the records or to deny the request. I don't know of any authority that would allow the WERC to manipulate or substitute information in those records.
Well, let me give you one. It's Osborne versus Board of Regents.
I'm sorry, which one?
The case Osborne versus Board of Regents, a case that this court decided in, I think it was 2002, in which the Board of Regents was required to produce records with personally identifiable information redacted.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So that can be done by a records custodian. You can take out personally identifiable information.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So how about if WERC provides these records during the conduct of the election, but redacts the personally identifiable information?
Mm-hmm. Well, since what was requested here was the names, which is a personally identifiable aspect, I guess, or piece of information, the redaction of the names from a list that would only include the names would, in effect, be a denial.
Okay. So you're not interested in the number of people that have voted by a particular point in an election. You want to know specifically who has voted.
Yeah, my client asked for the names, and that was what they were interested in obtaining. That's not to say that they wouldn't be interested in other pieces of information that might be publicly available during that recertification election process, but in this instance, what they were looking for was the names.
Right. So if you didn't get the names, that would be an unacceptable response.
I'm sorry, what?
If you didn't get the names, that would be an unacceptable response.
Well, it would be a denial of the request. Under the law, it would be a denial of the request.
Would it be unacceptable to MTI?
MTI requested the names.
Yes.
The names were denied. That was a denial of the records under the public records law.
And would that have been unacceptable to MTI?
Well, given that MTI requested the names, it would not have received the records that it sought. So if it had received something like a record that had a redaction of all the pieces of information that were requested, I think it would have filed a petition for a mandamus as it did in this case.
Okay, so the answer is yes, it would be unacceptable.
It's unacceptable under the law. You don't have to answer.
That's what I mean. We would be in the same position we're in right now, which is that MTI believes it has a right to these records under the public records law. It brought this case forward because it did not receive the records to which it believes it has a right.
You know, counsel, your client was seeking during the election, during an ongoing election,
mm-hmm.
Your client was seeking the names of the people who had voted, and the record discloses that your client would have had the access to the information then of all the members, so therefore it would have been a relatively simple matter of figuring out who had not voted. And so, right?
That's true. It could be determined from that record. That is absolutely true.
And do you disagree with any of your opposing counsel's descriptions as to what appears in the record as to different union members approaching other teachers or other employees affected by this in the schools with computers or coming in during the class, into classrooms and urging them, you know, with computers to log on and cast votes? That appears in the record, and that appears as a matter of fact.
I do take issue with the way that Mr. Scott's counsel characterized that evidence because it was presented and it is part of the record in this case that was an allegation that was brought forward in a different jurisdiction. That was a Racine case did not involve Madison teachers, did not involve the Madison School District, and it was also an allegation that the WERC chose not to investigate and, in fact, concluded was not substantiated because they chose not to investigate. So it is hanging out there as a mere unproven allegation, and I would also note that the allegation of what happened there had nothing to do with the union's access to a list of employees who had voted. It was
it was a
completely separate problem, and that gets in part to, you know, what the problem is here with Mr. Scott's denial of the records, because it is, you know, it's the wrong cure for, you know, the perceived disease.
Well, I want to explore that a little bit, because if you, if your client had received what it had requested, there really would have been nothing to stop the dissemination of that information to the members of the union. And those who would have been a little eager to persuade their colleagues or cajole their colleagues or whatever phrase you want to use to describe it, there would have been nothing to stop them from approaching those who had not yet cast a vote to do so.
That is certainly true, and it's also true, you know, today that the members of Madison Teachers who are in, who support Madison Teachers as their bargaining representative, can exercise their First Amendment rights to encourage their coworkers, to encourage other teachers to vote. They could do that whether they had the list of names. They can do that if they don't have the list of names. And they have a protected constitutional right to do that.
Well, of course they do, and nobody is arguing the contrary. What seems problematic, I think you made reference during the start of your presentation about the oversight of the democratic system.
Yes.
I found that quite interesting. You made reference to the democratic system because it seems that we go back to the lessons we learned during the first year of law school, and we learned that one of the hallmarks of the democratic system is the secret ballot, that the individual has the right to have a protected ballot, that how I vote, how my mother votes, how my siblings, friends, how you vote, you have the right to cast a secret ballot. Now, it seems to me that you have just acknowledged, well, you have just acknowledged, that you are going a step beyond, that you, that your clients could have gone well beyond the whole general First Amendment parameters of talking to whoever you want, of persuading whoever you want, of going door to door, of doing all of these things all of us who have ever run for election have done. But then we don't, those people who run for election don't usually go armed with the information of who's already voted which way. So I don't understand how you can say you have a constitution, your client has a constitutional right to the information of who voted a particular way, in this instance, by not voting at all, because a non-vote is a no vote.
Right. Well, and I'm happy to speak to that, and I think it's a really important issue here. I think it is very important to understand how the law treats non-votes here. What the law provides is that as a matter of law, the non-votes of employees are counted essentially against the union. That does not mean that any of those individual employees intended or didn't intend to vote against the union. Probably some of them did. By not casting a ballot, they understood that that meant that they would not be counted in support of the union. It's also equally possible that many of them didn't cast a ballot because they didn't get around to it. Maybe they were ill. Maybe they were extremely busy. We just don't know what they intended. Now, it's also equally true that...
Let me just offer you, let me just challenge you there a little bit on this. Gee, we're just completely baffled and mystified as to what their intentions were. They knew.
I,
they knew. that by not voting, that their ballot would be considered a no vote. That was not a secret. That was not kept secret from them, right?
That is true, but this is at the midpoint of the election. Any one of those employees could come in the same day. They could come in the next day, the next day, the next day, and cast their ballot. At that point in the process, we simply don't know what they intended. Many of them, you know, many employees will wait until the last day before they cast their ballot. We don't know at that point in time, at the time that MTI requested these records, the people who had not yet cast a ballot, their intentions were not known. It was, and I'm not trying to say that there was any confusion on the part of either MTI or any employee. I'm simply saying that as of that point in time, no one knows whether those employees would cast a ballot or not. We don't have a crystal ball, couldn't see into the future. Those were people who were still potential voters and could still cast a ballot before the end of the election.
Why not exercise what actually are your First Amendment rights and have the campaign for the general electorate? That is the typical exercise of the First Amendment right. Why do you need to target? Why do you need this list of people who haven't voted so you can target the ones who haven't voted? If you're advocating the great system of democracy, which you started your speech by, why wouldn't you just do that instead of demand from the record holder the lists of people who hadn't voted so that you could aim the efficiency of your client's organization on them?
Well, I think that in part you maybe you answered the question for me there at the end, Justice Gableman, by saying that it allows Madison teachers to focus its efforts on those who have not voted yet,
sure,
and that that's not inconsistent with their First Amendment rights.
It makes it easier, Ms. Crawford, doesn't it?
Certainly does.
It makes it easier to target the ones you know haven't voted. How democratic!
And MTI also exercises its First Amendment rights as to the entire body of employees, and it certainly has had to do that because WERC has withheld access to these public records. But this is a matter of public records law, and it is a matter of election oversight. So, for example, if Madison teachers had gotten that list halfway through the election, they would be able to review who was on record as having voted, and potentially could go back to employees to say, I thought you told me you had voted. Your name is not on this list. And that employee could say, I believed I had voted. Maybe we should look into this. So that is an example of how public oversight could be improved if the WERC would open up its process, allow the public to be able to see how this election is being administered by allowing access to those records while the election is happening.
Counsel, you recognize the danger of potential intimidation or coercion when armed with that kind of information, correct?
Well, what I would say about that, Your Honor, is that under the balancing test, what the case law teaches us is that in a circumstance like this where...
Yeah, just as a factual matter, you recognize that. Yes?
I do not recognize it as a significant threat of harm in this case.
Well, your MTI, when it alerted that there were going to be record requests, took pains to say, and we promise we won't use this information for intimidation or coercion, right?
Right, and it did that because the year before it had asked for the same records. Many unions have asked for the same records, and they have gotten exactly the same response, which is, we don't trust you with this information. We don't trust the public with these records because we believe you may use it for an improper purpose. And when there are many different cases in which the courts have looked at that type of rationale for denying a public record request under the balancing test. And what the courts teach us is that it's important to look at the severity of the threatened harm and also how likely that harm is to occur. And under these facts and this record, I believe that Mr. Scott has not shown that the harm that's threatened is severe and has also not shown that it's likely to occur.
Right.
And
so,
I would ask
So I understand you disagree with the chairman on that point, but MTI did find it important, at least, to say we promise that we won't use the information for those purposes, right?
And they did that because Mr. Scott, in previous record requests, had said, we believe you're going to use this information to intimidate people. So MTI said, as a matter of assurance, no, that is not our purpose. We have no intention of doing that.
Okay. So so let's say that was sufficient to satisfy the chairman with respect to MTI.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But if MTI received that information, it could turn around and redistribute that information to anyone it wanted, correct?
Well, the information, if it were public, it's public, you know, it's public. It's public to anyone. That's correct.
Counsel, the facts of this case indicate that initially, as I understand it, in a certain year, you went in and asked for a declaratory judgment and mandamus, and the court ended up, because you received the information, giving a declaratory judgment. Of what import is it that the court gave a declaratory judgment rather than a mandamus in this case?
Well, just to be clear on that point, what MTI asked for as a remedy was mandamus. It asked the court to order Scott to turn over the records. The court decided that because counsel for MTI had received the record in a discovery response, that there was essentially no practical point, no effect in ordering Scott to turn over the records in response to the public record request to MTI. So the court elected to exercise its authority to make a declaratory judgment, which was that Mr. Scott had violated the public record law when it refused to provide that record.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't think that that is significant to this case. Mr. Scott's counsel argues that this is more focused on the disclosure of the record in discovery, that should have cut off Madison Teachers' right to recover its attorney's fees. And you know, we disagree with that because at no point did Mr. Scott raise that as a reason for terminating the litigation. And further, Mr. Scott never conceded that record, that MTI was entitled to have that record under the public records law. It simply was turning it over in response to a fairly broad discovery request that asked for email correspondence between the WERC and its contractor, AAA. I would just like to
I'm going to interject one more thing.
Go ahead.
Voter intimidation is of great concern, right? And heralding the public records law and what it stands for is also so important. And of course, the statute of the legislature says any requester, you don't look at the identity. And motivation gets you to a real slippery slope.
Right.
As I understand it here, the motivation is in part for voter intimidation at another union, at another place, and another election was seen previously, allegation not substantiated. How do you draw the line? How are you suggesting we draw the line in balancing? After all, this is a balancing test.
Right, and it's you know, the balancing test is it requires the court to look at all of the facts and circumstances and to balance, you know, the very strong interest in openness of government against the interests that are put forward by the custodian. And in cases like this, where the harm that's being alleged as a basis for withholding the record is not because of the content of the records, here, you know, it's a list of names of public employees, but rather that someone might use those records for an improper purpose, what the case law teaches us is that it's important for the court to assess how likelihood is that threat of harm to occur, and how severe is the threatened harm. So, for example, in a recent case, I believe just decided by a couple of cases recently decided by the Court of Appeals, there was a request made by an individual who was under a domestic abuse injunction and sought records of his estranged spouse's employment. And in that case, it wasn't the content of the record so much as what, you know, the threatened harm was. And the court in that case found that on those facts, there was a sufficiently severe threat and a sufficient likelihood of that harm to occur that it warranted not disclosing the records. Now, another case is the McIver Institute versus Senator Erpenbach case, in which Senator Erpenbach redacted the names from constituent emails. And he said he did that, and there were constituent emails related to Act 10. And in that case, Senator Erpenbach said there's a possibility of these individuals being harassed, of being intimidated, of being threatened. And the court in that case said the likelihood of that threat is insufficient under this record to warrant the non-disclosure of those records. It did not prevail over the very strong public interest in openness in government. So I think that those are two important cases that provide a context for this. As is actually another case, similarly, was the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel versus Department of Administration case from several years ago, about 10 years ago, in which the state withheld a list of union employees, relying on a provision in a collective bargaining agreement and also under the balancing test. Again, it was, the threat that the release of those names would invade people's privacy, cause them some potential for harassment, et cetera. And the court said, under these facts, that the potential for those harms is simply not there, not sufficient to overcome the very strong public interest in openness.
Counsel, does it make a difference that the cases you cite don't relate to harassment in regard to vote, but regard harassment in other circumstances?
You said harassment in regard to voting?
Does it matter that the cases that you're talking about do not relate to voting, which is what we're looking at here, and relate to harassment in other circumstances?
Well, I don't think that that's a basis for distinguishing the kind of analysis that the court goes through in looking at the weight to give to the interests that are at stake.
Well, is voting a more highly protected right than the other ones you're speaking of?
I guess I have a hard time answering that question because I don't think that the release of the records in this case, I don't think there's any allegation that would prevent any of these employees from exercising what is a statutory right to vote or not vote in a recertification election.
Yeah, but that wasn't the question.
I'm sorry.
The question was whether the when you look at the balance, protecting the vote may be a stronger interest in that balance than if you were balancing some other interest.
Well, the way I guess I would try to answer that is to say that if the right to vote in a recertification election were at stake here, then yes, but I don't believe that the right to vote in a recertification is at stake here. In other words, Mr. Scott is not saying, if I provide you these records, someone may not be able to exercise the right to vote. That really is not what the rationale was.
Or someone may vote who would have chosen not to.
Right. That's possible, too. And it's also important to note that those who cast a ballot can vote for the union, they can vote against the union.
Absolutely.
And some of them do. You know, there's never 100% of the votes in favor of the union in these elections.
Thank you.
Just briefly, I'd like to turn to, I'm sorry that I don't remember which justice asked these questions, but you know, whether the WERC is seeking a decision in this case which would amount to sort of a blanket exemption under the public records law, and I believe it certainly would, because in this case, it's hard to imagine when and under what circumstances the WERC would be required to provide the records that were sought here in a future case under different facts, because there is no history of voter coercion, harassment, or threats that was demonstrated here as a basis for MTI not to receive such records. So in any future case, all Mr. Scott would have to do is to say there is some possibility that such threatened harms may occur, and you know, if the court in this case upholds his decision to deny the records in this case, I think it will have established a blanket exemption under the public records law. I would like to, since it looks like I have a bit of time remaining, just to turn briefly to the attorney fees issues that are part of this case, and to point out that there are many cases in which a custodian, the requester obtains access to the record as part of the litigation, as part of an in-camera review process occasionally. I think that was the case in a case the court decided last year involving some videotapes of the Attorney General to which the Democratic Party was seeking access. There are circumstances where the requester will or the requester's counsel will have access to the records at some point in the litigation, and that does not preclude the requester from being entitled to an award of attorney fees if the requester prevails on the public issue, the public record issues that are presented in the
litigation. It's not that there's no entitlement to attorney fees. It's whether the attorney fees stop being counted as soon as they get the records.
Right.
And your position, if I understand it, is you get all the attorney fees even though you got the records in discovery.
That's right.
And
in
don't
part,
dig
that's
that.
Because had Mr. Scott had a change of heart halfway through the litigation and said, here's your record, I understand I'm obliged to provide this as a response to a public record request, that case is over. And MTI would be entitled only to the fees that had accumulated up to that point, because the litigation would have been successful in prevailing on that public record issue. That's not what happened here. Mr. Scott made no such concession, was not providing the records in response to the public record request, but turned them over because they fell into a broad discovery request in the case.
But they got the records.
Correct. Counsel got the records.
Counsel, but not the client? Is that your point? I mean, what separates getting the records and getting fees up to getting the records and getting the records but getting fees all the way through litigation?
I see my red line light is on.
You may briefly answer.
I'll try to be very brief. The difference between what happened in this case and what happened in previous cases is that the records were provided only in discovery without acknowledging that there was any obligation to do so under the public records law. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Your Honors, I'm going to apologize in advance. I have 5 minutes. I'm going to start talking very quickly, I believe. If I'm talking too fast, please call me out on that. But I have four things I'd like to get through. One is with regard to opposing counsel's statement that the evidence was unsubstantiated. Well, there is no case law that says evidence has to be substantiated for a public records custodian to make a denial. Hempel teaches that hard evidence is not required to support a records custodian's concern when it is a reason for denial.
Let me stop you on your number one, and I'll be quick, too. My concern is that you really are creating a blanket rule. And, of course, only the legislature can create a blanket rule. There's no evidence here, that's what you're talking about, number one, that's why I'm stopping you. There's no evidence here in the record to indicate any intimidation or voter coercion. Rather, there's a concern based on someplace else, some other election, some other time. Won't that concern always raise a specter? I'm always concerned of the legitimacy of the election, and therefore I'm always concerned about voter intimidation when there's this kind of a request, and therefore it really is a blanket exemption or exception that you are asking us to create rather than the legislature.
I'm sure there's always going to be a concern. But in the facts of the case here, what Mr. Scott was presented with was knowledge that the previous year there had been allegations of coercion. So he was presented with the decision, do I consider these allegations a year out? Yes.
How about 2 years out? How about 3 years out? How about 5 years out?
Right. And unfortunately, can't answer that because it's a balancing test. We were never going to know. But what I can say...
Counsel, what I heard you to say was that there was information, there was evidence, but there were no convictions. That's right. What I thought, unless my memory is playing tricks.
Right. It was never substantiated or confirmed that threats took place, but there were certainly complaints that threats took place, and the case law doesn't require...
In other elections.
In other elections, but the case law doesn't require that there be convictions so that Mr. Scott could have said, ah.
And that those complaints, those registered concerns, those are in the record.
Those are in the record, yes, Your Honor. And based on those, the likelihood, Chairman Scott believed, went from a possibility to a probability. And that's what the McIver Institute v. Erpenbach case says. The Court of Appeals agreed that there could be instances of actual threats of harassment that could lead to a denial. In that case, there weren't any. There was nothing in the record with the emails that were presented that showed that there were any threats to the requester. And so the court said, well, there's no probability here. There's no reasonable probability that there could take place. I also note, to get to the Chief Justice's question, is that situation didn't include elections. That situation didn't include a governmental, didn't include any type of governmental function going on at the same time. Here, there is elections going on. Also, I'd like to talk about public oversight. Opposing counsel said that public records law was the only means of public oversight during an election. That assumes that the request and the demand for the records at a time certain that the requester made is going to be responded to by Mr. Scott. There's nothing in the record that showed that Mr. Scott could have responded in time to the requester's certain date. By which MTI wanted Mr. Scott to respond. Nothing in the record. The only thing in the record is evidence of what was happening a month later when no elections.
Did that date happen to be before or after the election was completed?
It was before the election was complete. Yes. Also, opposing counsel talked about, for the purposes of attorney's fees, that in-camera review shows that fees can continue to be paid. But in-camera reviews are not the same as a disclosure in a discovery request when there is certainly not any type of protective order. So in this case, Chairman Scott provided the records in a discovery response. There was nothing from the circuit court that said only counsel for MTI had access to that. So by way of the response, it would get into MTI's hand. And I strongly disagree, if I may finish, if my light is on.
Your light is on. Be very quick.
That Mr. Scott's failure to say This is a response to a public records request. At the same time, it was a response to a discovery request, would allow MTI to continue receiving fees after that point. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you. Thank you both. This is a very, very interesting case. Given all the public attention there was to Act 10 when it first came down, I thought we'd be getting cases about it much more frequently and much sooner than we have. So thank you. The brief was very good and very helpful, and so was oral argument. Students, if you want to hang around, I'm going to come out there and we can chat a little bit.